Meandering in the margins of medicine, it's the Short Coat Podcast.
Weird news,
fresh views,
helpful clues and interviews.
By students, for students.
Subscribe to our weekly show at theshortcoat.com.
Welcome back to the Short Coat Podcast. Dave Etler here, along with Casey McCleary, Eric Wilson, Nathan Miller, Corbin Weaver, and Casey... did I already say Casey McCleary?
Yeah, but I'm worth mentioning twice.
Absolutely. Look, listeners, let me say first, thanks for tuning in. You've been so loyal and lovely. Though I have to say, we could stand to hear from you more often at theshortcoat.com/tell us. To reward you for your loyalty and your loveliness, I'm going to recite a poem today. Yes. Every day we be burning, not concerning what nobody want to say. We be earning dollars turning because we mind a pawn we play. I don't even know. I hope that doesn't mean anything nasty. Some got gold and oil and diamonds. All we got is Mary J. Legalize it. Time to recognize it. Does anybody recognize that lovely piece of poetry?
I'm going to go out on a limb and guess Snoop Dogg?
No.
No.
No. That is oh, Corey knows.
Sean Paul.
Oh, yeah. That is indeed a lovely verse by the great poet Sean Paul, who
beautiful.
I'm sure doesn't speak for anyone here on this show. He's talking, of course, about cannabis, the topic of today's show. Not since 1969 has it been so popular and so unpopular at the same time. People crave it. People rally around it. People may actually need it for medical reasons that have nothing to do with getting high. On the other hand, people fear it. People revile it. And people say that the risks may outweigh the benefits. Nevertheless, 23 states have legalized cannabis for medical use. 4 states have legalized recreational use as well. Meanwhile, the Obama administration opposes it, saying that legalizing it would increase availability, normalize its use, which would lead to increased health consequences, especially for young people. But it's worth noting that in December of this past year, Congress quietly ended the federal ban on medical uses of cannabis, tucked into an appropriations bill where we wouldn't see it. So,
sneaky.
I'm curious. What do you guys talk about marijuana, medical or otherwise?
We haven't really done anything as far as pharmacology. We're just kind of stepping into that. So, as far as its efficacy, I don't really know anything. We talk a little bit about it maybe in mass, but not even directly. So, I think someone who's had a little more experience with the curriculum.
Do we know anybody like that, Eric Wilson?
I don't remember. Once you get past that point, you try to block it out of your mind sometimes. But I don't recall us talking much at all about medical marijuana or cannabis and its effects. And I think part of that is due to the just complete lack of science surrounding its effects.
Yeah.
It just kind of historically has been banned or, you know, been like a illegal drug for so long that there really hasn't been any science done on it. So I don't think they can even teach us anything.
Yeah, there are some pretty recent studies that are being done in Canada and the handful of states that have fully legalized it, but, you know, a lot of those results are very preliminary. We don't know a lot about the long-term usage, so it is worth noting that there is not a lot of good long-term research on it.
There's a few things that my research turned up that I found was interesting. The University of Mississippi apparently has a potency monitoring program and has found that the jump in potency, or the jump in THC concentrations, has been basically 3.4% THC in 1993 to 12.3% in 2012. And I guess it's worth noting that THC is only one of the many compounds in marijuana. I mean, there's apparently hundreds, thousands, maybe. We don't really know, right? Because there's THC and then there's something else.
Cannabinoids.
Yeah, there's C something. CNBC. I don't know. They apparently have different effects, is what I've read. And they think that, you know, there's this concern about paranoia or not paranoia, concern about psychotic symptoms and basically, you know, non-psychotic symptoms. And each one affects, each compound affects each thing differently. And I'm totally not explaining this well. Would somebody else explain this, please?
Well, my understanding of it is, so last summer I was in Colorado, just like visiting some friends and stuff, and I got a chance to speak with somebody who was a manager of a
I really thought you were going to say something else.
But spoke with a manager of a air quotes
medical marijuana store that was kind of transitioning to recreational use too. And it was just interesting asking all of my kind of sciencey medical student questions about, well, what's in it and what do you do, and interesting how they just kind of refine it and get rid of a lot of those things that can cause, as you said, kind of like the psychotic effects. And really it's about isolating those things that may have some benefit. We say may because we don't really know.
Right.
So the point of it, my understanding, you know, for most of it's like not to get high, is to try to find something that will be useful. But right now it's, from their perspective, it was all kind of stories of this person had this, this person had that. So we don't have the, you know, hard evidence to back it up quite yet. But it's something that I don't see why not. Like, why not investigate it if it can help someone?
Marijuana is federally currently considered to be a Schedule 1 drug. And for those of you who don't know anything about the scheduling systems, Schedule 1 is considered to be, like, the most dangerous drugs, the ones with no potential medical usage, and the one with, like, high addiction and high risk potential. And really none of that is scientifically backed up at all. There has been enough research done on marijuana to know that it has a relatively low addiction rate, especially once you're past your teenage years. I don't think has ever killed anyone except indirectly. It's basically impossible to die from.
It's impossible to overdose on. Yeah.
Yeah. The handful of deaths that have been attributed to it were later found to be due to people like either doing stupid things or like choking on their own vomit because they were unconscious. But who knows if cannabis was the only, you know, drug in those cases. But you basically can't overdose on it, so there's no risk. There's potential medical use. Well, not no risk. There's very low risk of physical harm
in comparison to other things.
In comparison to other drugs.
Other drugs.
Yeah, there's basically no reason it should be a Schedule 1 drug, and that to me is just like the best example of how politicized and how much propaganda has basically surrounded and infiltrated the discussion, like to the point that it's almost impossible to even have the discussion in this country.
So going back to what I tried to inarticulately say before about the potency of marijuana, how it's, or you know, the potency of concentrations in recreational marijuana. So divorcing this from medical marijuana, which can be more controlled. High Times magazine, always an excellent source of science, I'm sure.
My favorite scientific journal.
Anyway, analyzed 15 strains and found potency ranging from 25 to 28% THC. Obviously, that's much larger than the 3.4% THC that the University of Mississippi has been found in 1993. And I think it's pretty commonly known that potency has increased over the years.
Ain't what we smoked in my parents' day.
Exactly. And so that kind of worries me. I mean, I'm not opposed to things like legalization personally, I'm not opposed to things like legalization and medical marijuana, especially not medical marijuana. But that jump in potency sort of concerns me for a lot of reasons. I mean, I can't, you know, for instance, I couldn't say to my kids, oh, I'll give it a try. You know, like, see what happens, you know, like I might have in 1993, for instance.
So I guess what I would say, if it is legalized, I imagine while you may have a higher concentration, it would be more standardized across the board, so you'd know what to expect, and you'd be less likely to have more or less than what you desire.
Right.
So I feel like,
and that's one of the arguments for regulation.
Yeah,
for,
it seems like that'd be a positive step as far as the concentration goes, not a negative thing.
Yeah, we're
absolutely.
Go ahead.
I mean, and also, there is something to, you know, the idea of regulating those lines of manufacturing, you know, that's good from regulating potency as well. Of course, there is a flip side to that argument, and the fact that our black market marijuana supplies are very well established, and they're not going to go away under a legalization premise in the whole country.
Yeah, they in fact, yeah, if you start regulating things to a certain percentage, well, then they may just, you know, the black market may just establish itself as a place to get more potent than you can get legally.
Yeah, and that's definitely something that states should consider as more and more states are legalizing recreational marijuana. Just for the record, it is now Washington, Colorado, that everybody knows. Also Oregon and Alaska more recently.
In Hawaii.
Oh, in Hawaii.
No, I'm sorry. That's not true.
Dang it, Dave.
Is it District of Columbia or is that just medical?
DC's medical. All the rest are medical.
I think everything else is medical. Yeah. And then there are a handful of decriminalization laws, which are even more complicated and different.
Like in Iowa, where where it's medical marijuana is legal, but you can't buy it or sell it. So
yeah.
That's weird.
Well, it's only legal for like some really, really like specific conditions, I think.
Right.
It's not very...
Cannabis and cannabis oil, I think, is the, the specific thing.
But anyway, yeah, so some of the states are having trouble sort of rooting out their black markets, but especially if they're, like, taxing it too high or regulating it too much, you know, then you're going to have trouble getting rid of that black market because it's very well established. So, you know, there's a lot of discussion about what to do about that, but I think my impression was that, at least Washington, I lived in Washington last year, and... They were even with a relatively high tax, doing an okay job of having a lot of people trying to buy it legally, because people want to be able to get it legally. You don't want to have to worry about getting arrested for something stupid when you can do it legitimately. And they had huge, huge, huge numbers of people applying for permits to be able to sell it. Like, people want to be able to do this legitimately.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you're probably right about that, but... I actually also lived in Washington for a year, and
nice.
It's hard. I would love to see the numbers on who. I mean, the problem is you can't do a research study on, hey, do you buy your pot legally or illegally? Really, I mean, people aren't going to be honest about that. You know, you get like pulled over. Let's say you have pot; it's legal. Can a cop see? I bought this from the pot shop down the road, or I bought this from my dealer.
I got my receipts.
You know, but I mean, this is a minor issue. It's just something to think about.
Yeah, that's true. And it would probably be more relevant for distributors than for people who are actually buying it. Like, the distributors would probably be more concerned about legitimacy than the people actually using it, because it is hard to prove, like, well, you didn't get that from a real source, you know.
It's Jason Lewis.
Yes.
Jason Lewis has stopped by.
Hi, I've decided to, you know, move away from the camera. So I grew up in West Virginia. It's been said often that if pot were legalized in West Virginia tomorrow, it would become by far the number one cash crop in the state, like just overnight, because there's a huge growing industry in West Virginia. So I mean, extrapolate that out to what the potential is for other places. You know, farming is not something that's, you know, making the kind of money that it used to. I mean, there's a lot of opportunity for economic stimulus in the pot industry. And when we live in a country where we do sell something that you could smoke that actually kills you,
yes,
it seems like not too far a leap.
Yeah, like nobody's really like, oh, you know, there's no harm in nicotine.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure it'll be fine.
Yeah. I mean... other than when you die from cancer and stuff.
Well, what's interesting is that, I read that there's a Columbia neuroscientist whose name escapes me for the moment, has found that experienced users given strong pot smoke less, right? Experienced users, that's the caveat there.
People who know what they're doing.
Yes. So the question becomes, does stronger pot mean less cancer from pot smoking? Which I thought was, and I hadn't occurred to me before.
You would think so if you're getting a higher concentration of the desired.
Yeah, so maybe chemicals. Maybe the solution is just crank up the THC.
There you go.
That is not a solution I've heard proposed before.
Are you saying lower cancer in the sense of like lower lung cancer from the inhalation?
From inhalation, right.
Okay, so
offsetting it's less, the potential dangers of smoking pot.
Yeah, I mean, smoking anything will give you lung cancer eventually, so it's.
I don't know of any doctors who are like, yeah, it's okay to smoke once.
Yeah,
cigarettes.
Even most medical practitioners who are okay with medical marijuana would prefer you to take it in like a capsule with oil or like an edible. Edibles are getting really popular with regards to medical marijuana because they last a lot longer. They have it's a very different type of high than the smoking. That for some people can be a little more manageable, and you have a much lower risk of that, like, cancerous smoke inhalation. The problem isn't the active compounds, it's the smoke.
Although, with edible pot, it's with smoked pot, the effects are quicker to be perceived by the user than edible pot, which means that with edible pot, you may end up consuming more than you think you're consuming until, you know, it sort of kicks in. In which case, I mean, you know, like you can titrate if you're smoking a little bit more effectively than you can apparently if you're eating it.
That is very true, and it is very, very possible to have a bad psychological experience.
Bad trip, man.
Using
that's
marijuana.
Where whoever's selling it to you should just do a little coaching if you're a first time user or something like that. You know,
If you're getting it from a doctor, maybe the doctor can talk to you about these things.
Just like any of your other drugs,
could be distributed like pharmaceuticals. Like, okay, take this much. It's distributed. Maybe only take one candy per day or whatever.
I mean, that kind of that's problematic because it relies on patient compliance, though.
We just
talked about today how a wife was getting when she had a headache, she'd take an extra dose of her.
Blood pressure high medicine?
Yeah, her blood pressure medicine.
Cholesterol.
It's like, no, don't do that.
Well, I mean,
is that how it works?
We give people warfarin, Coumadin every single day, and it causes so many
more dangerous.
it also relies on patient compliance, and it's just a matter of education and then fingers crossed, and you know, come back if you see this.
I was just gonna say, I'm hoping with better technology we can maybe get some apps or something that people can look at and be like, okay, this is what I'm supposed to do with this medicine, and just do a really quick reference so that people are a little bit less like, I think they said twice a day, but I don't really remember. I'm gonna like cut it in half and drink it with a beer or something. I'm sure it'll be fine. Like, I didn't have people do the weirdest things with their medications.
What are the medical uses of cannabis these days? I mean, I think anxiety, I think, is one of the things that I've read.
Anxiety. I know, like,
appetite. Anxiety.
I've heard, like, chronic pain type situations.
Yeah. Yep.
Stimulating appetite. And I thought the thing in Iowa was there's some seizure disorders
helpful for. One of the senators, or wait, is he a senator? One of the people in the Iowa Congress.
Like state senator.
Yeah, like a state. Yeah. Vanderplaats.
Yes.
For anybody who is in the voting area, just
he's actually doesn't. I don't think he has a position.
Oh, He
just came out with a position.
No, I mean he doesn't have an elected position.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What is he?
He's
maybe he
just
do.
Loud.
Okay.
So this dude, anyway, his child has like a brain disorder, and he's been learning about like medical marijuana and use for seizure disorders and epilepsy, and has recently like come out being loud, apparently saying how he thinks medical marijuana should be
Corey, who is this
legalized.
Vanderplaats? Would you look him up for us?
Bob Vanderplaats?
I'm pretty sure that's
yeah,
who it
that's
was.
Him. He's from my hometown, actually.
Yeah, I've heard that name before, and I have usually remember having it with negative
Iowa
connotations,
family,
so I was surprised to hear it.
Iowa Family Values or something. I don't know. Something like
anything
that.
With family values seems sketchy to me. I don't know. That term has been misused so much.
Another common use I've heard of is glaucoma, and
yes.
It's very, very prevalent in the U.S. Multiple millions of people, I believe, have it, and it seems like a relatively easy treatment if it's actually effective. I haven't seen any studies on it, but I've heard it as a common one.
Yeah, I think that one's like toward the bottom, sort of the list of effectiveness. You know, I think pain and anxiety are like way up at the top, and glaucoma is a little bit more questionable, but there is still some evidence for it. So see, that's one of the ones you'd want to really research,
right,
and then find out like how much do you need to relieve these symptoms, and how much good is it going to do versus...
So from the government's perspective, do you legalize it before you do that research, or do you wait and make sure you're not going to cause any problems and make people more blind or whatever?
Sure.
Like glaucoma.
Here's what I would say. I think we should legalize it recreationally before we throw ourselves headfirst into it medically, because medically you have doctors who maybe don't have as good like evidence-based practice who are going to be giving it to patients, and doctors you'd think we'd want to be like more trusted about this. But with regards to recreational, like, that's people's own choice. You know, there's not a professional saying, here, we think this will help you. So I feel like the legalization of it recreationally is a lot more... it's a lot less risky to people like practitioners, but could still allow people who need it to be able to go out and get it.
It's far more riskier, like liability-wise, to the federal government, though, because people who see that they legalize it then assume, oh, it's okay for me to take this. It's healthy, or, you know, it's not harmful.
Well, yeah, I mean, you still want to spread information
part
about
my food
it.
Pyramid.
But it's also, like, the fact that it's not legal to society. Oh, Jason, are you leaning in to say something?
Go ahead.
Okay. I was just going to say that it has a huge social cost to society. It has a huge economic cost for people being in jail, being arrested for very minor offenses. It has a huge life cost for people being in jail, being felons. That goes on your record forever for nonviolent crimes and can like tear apart families because somebody goes to jail and they have to leave their family behind. They can't help provide for that family now. And so it basically is a huge cost to society. So is that worse than the handful of people who wouldn't pay attention to the education? I don't think so.
For the record, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to add, I think Casey's point is a really good one. I mean, the societal cost in terms of incarceration and, you know, potentially unjust laws that are sort of governing possession and sales maybe is one thing, but possession and usage. But there's also the idea that, I mean, the somewhat hypocritical stance of like, well, we sell cigarettes and alcohol.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And neither one of them can be really, you can't defend them as healthy.
They are not safe.
Being
they
safe,
are
not right.
Healthy. You know, and there are age limits for when you're old enough to purchase those things. You're supposed to be able to make those kinds of decisions. And so we're willing to trust the general public to make certain kinds of decisions about purchasing mind-altering products, and yet it really is. There's a stigma attached to this that is probably, you know, more unwarranted than people want to admit.
I mean, it's from decades of law enforcement and being a Schedule I drug. I mean, that's
right. Right.
And I mean, to that point, there's two points. And actually, this is Iowa. The fact that we're in Iowa is a great. Great example for this is that actually Iowa is the worst in terms of marijuana arrest discrepancies amongst Black Americans and white Americans. And I mean, that trend is the worst in Iowa, but it continues throughout the U.S. So that's something
racial discrepancy.
Right. And that's something to think about when you think about who's really paying for these for this law. But something I on the other side of the coin as well, and this is not a reason not to, you know, go ahead and legalize marijuana, but it's something to consider from a public health standpoint is, and maybe a way to proactively get around, is that when I was living in Washington, actually, I worked in a clinic, and we would sometimes have to tell parents, like, no, you can't smoke pot around your newborn child.
True.
You know, like, and it's different if, like, I mean, secondhand smoke is obviously an issue, but I mean, if mom and dad crack a beer at the end of the day, baby's not gonna get that. So I mean, it's something to consider when we talk about education, and maybe with a more normalized society that's more used to a legalized pot, that wouldn't be as big of an issue, but something to consider.
For the record, Vanderplaats is a Christian conservative leader, which makes actually his position even more interesting.
Fascinating.
Yeah. It's because something happened in his family that made it feel relevant to him and that forced him to think about it. And a lot of people are really unwilling to approach issues like this at all or to reconsider their positions until it directly affects them. I think that's a really sad thing about a lot of people, especially politicians.
We need to take a break. We'll be right back on the Short Code Podcast.
The Art of Medicine podcast explores topics in medicine through the lens of the arts and social sciences. Learn about an epileptic woman who created a virtual reality grand mal seizure, what doctors can learn from jazz musicians, and the experience of sexual assignment in a medicalized body. Download us on iTunes and visit us at www.theartofmedicinepodcast.com. We are a member of the Vocalis Network, the podcast network for medical students. Please listen to our partner podcasts at vocalisnetwork.wix.com/listen.
We're back on the Short Code Podcast. Eric, you had something you want to say?
Yeah, so we talked a little bit about there's like edible forms and pills and things, but another form that medical marijuana can take is this kind of, I don't know how to describe it other than a kind of a crystallized oil.
It's a wax.
Like a wax, yeah. And so the method there is you're still going to inhale it, but you have to essentially vaporize that wax, put it on a very, very hot metal thing, and then inhale.
The vape life is how I've heard it.
But
They look like little e-cigs, basically.
Huh. But so there's also like home things that people create, and that this is leading into my thing where one health concern I've heard about is that this oil can get incredibly hot and can like splash up into people's eyes and cause dramatic like burn injuries to their face.
Sounds fantastic. So you're high and burning.
So if you don't take proper safety precautions, if your thing isn't working all that great, you know, or then you could have these burn injuries. I've heard of again, only anecdotal evidence, but you know, people in ERs because of like burn injuries, and you have to wear protective goggles and things when you're using it this way. So.
I think, yeah, wow. I think
they must have some really intense machinery, because that's not the stuff that I'm familiar with at all.
Well, you know, it's like I mean, everybody, a lot of people know how you know how the genius that pot users express when trying to come up with a new way to
innovation
smoke,
I think
like,
is the word you're looking for,
or you know if they left their pipe somewhere and they have nothing to use, they'll like hollow out a gourd or something.
Potato. I've seen someone smoke a potato.
Oh yeah,
it's, out of a,
you know, it really is a testament to the ingenuity of the American spirit.
Yes.
But I also wanted to say, you know, it's really funny, like Eric brings up this possibility of, you know, getting the stuff on you. I mean, this coming from a nation that you know, has deep-fried turkeys in hot oil, right? And you had to explosive, tell people to like, be aware not to deep-fry a frozen turkey.
People aren't real smart.
Yeah. No.
I guess. So. Well, there we go.
So since we've been talking about legalization in America, I think it might be worth talking about some other countries that
I don't know much about
have
either.
Legalized.
Are there other countries out there anywhere?
Wait, what?
Do we have other countries on this planet?
I think there are some continents.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
Canada is the obvious one, and I think they've had a lot of success with their medicalization of marijuana, although they've had, you know, they've had some bumps in the road, too.
I think that's sort of inevitable. I mean, there's a lot. It's a complicated situation. You know?
It is.
I don't think we should expect that in this country, anyway. I don't think we should expect it to be a smooth sailing kind of thing, you know.
Oh, no, certainly
anyway,
not.
Go on.
Especially if we're doing it in stages like decriminalization and then medical. And then,
right.
Yeah. But I think... I know the Netherlands has some laws. I'm not as familiar with those if anybody else is. But Portugal decriminalized... I think they just decriminalized, but they decriminalized everything across the board.
I had read that, yes.
In... Oh, God, what year was it?
Well...
2000, I think? I don't
sure,
know.
Let's
it was
just
around
say it was.
The turn of the millennium. But, I mean, it's been like 15 years or something since then. So basically... not only has their country not deteriorated, but they're doing a lot better. They had huge, huge numbers of drug arrests, and for a long time they were trying to do what we were doing, which is just cracking down harder and harder and arrest more people, be, you know, stronger punishments, and it just wasn't working. Things just kept getting worse, so they got together this panel of scientists, and the scientists were like, you know what you gotta do? Decriminalize everything, and they were like, okay, we'll try it.
I love that. I don't know. I just love the idea that they're just like, okay.
Yeah, they were like, we hired a bunch of experts, and now we're going to listen to our experts.
Let's not only try this one thing, but let's try all of it. that's an amazing... I was stunned by that when I read that. I'm like, really? Wow, that's gutsy. Anyway.
Yeah, I think it's intense.
It is gutsy, and I don't know, from my perspective, perhaps a little negligent.
Well, it helps that they're a smaller country than the U.S. too. Like, that would be a lot more tricky to do here, I think.
Wow.
But yeah, I mean, it sounds like my impression is that it's been extremely successful, and then the money and part of that is not because they just decriminalized everything. They took all the money that they were putting into arresting people and prosecuting people and all that, and they started pumping it into treatment programs for people who had become addicted and wanted to become unaddicted. They started pumping it into social programs to give people reasons to live that weren't drugs. And that, I think, has been the most successful part of the program. And it's the fact that people have a purpose. Like, you're so much less likely to get addicted to drugs if you have a fulfilling life.
Have something other than drugs to sustain you.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably the key to what all of this is. It's not necessarily like we don't prosecute these drugs aren't dangerous, and so we shouldn't, you know, prosecute people for drugs. I think the the key is, like, if in this country we don't really have a rehabilitative criminal justice system. It's, you know,
we make our criminals worse.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And so if you take that money and you create a system that restores people rather than just
destroys them.
Destroys them.
Punishing them and hoping they disappear.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So
yeah, that's a good point. So what you're saying is this whole decriminalization, legalization thing might actually be doomed to failure simply because we don't have good alternatives for certain groups.
Right.
That isn't what I was saying, but I do think it's a valid concern. Like, now that you bring it up.
I think without programs in place to restore people who are having problems with drugs, because people will, if they use them, have problems. I mean,
yes.
Putting marijuana aside, let's talk about, you know, people will have problems with them. They'll become addicted to, like, meth and cocaine. If you don't have systems to help people in place, social systems established by the government, it'll get out of control. So if you decriminalize, you have to be prepared for those consequences.
I just imagine with all the savings you're going to have from, you know, not detaining these people and prosecuting them, like, I feel like the cost of establishing rehab programs in place of all this, like, this huge prison system, it'd be so much cheaper.
Right. It'd be a snap, wouldn't it? I mean, like, if only we could just divert all of that money.
It would be cheaper in monetary terms and
billions
cheaper in human resources.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
just,
without a doubt,
like,
yeah.
You know, the quality of life that people experience.
Yeah. I think one thing that sort of stands in our way as a culture in the United States, though, is that there is this mindset that there are certain things that are forbidden and signs of weakness, and that permeates a lot of how we go about our daily lives. I mean, to say, like, you know, you're addicted to a substance and that's a failure.
Yeah.
You know, and so as such you should feel shame. Mm-hmm. And we really have to come a long way in getting away from, you know, people's shortcomings becoming, you know, ways that they should feel like less of a person. Mm-hmm. And reach out. I mean, you know, being founded as a Christian nation all those years ago, there's not a lot of Christian compassion that comes about when someone struggles. I mean, I'm not saying that there aren't organizations that do show that. However, I think that our holistic mindset as a nation is one of, like, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. You've
get it together, loser.
I think we're finally making some progress as far in the mental health community, as far as that's concerned. And that'll transition into these other issues with dependence on drugs.
Yeah, there's a huge overlap between substance abuse and mental health issues. And so part of, if we do end up having, like, decriminalization, not only can people with, like, anxiety maybe use something like marijuana for treatment, but they are also less likely to just, like, someone with schizophrenia is much less likely to be, you know, caught with some drug trying to self-medicate and shuffled off into the prison system.
Good point.
Because lots of people with mental health problems try to self-medicate.
Yeah. Well, I have some news items to talk about. Does anybody object to me moving on to news items?
But Reefer Madness.
David,
well, it sort of...
I thought we were going to give out our own sort of, like... Are we going to do that exchange that we talked about with, you know, our own recipes for...
I forgot my recipes.
Are we not posting this on the Short Coat Podcast website?
Oh, I forgot. Yes, next time. On the addiction front, however, or on the drug front, powdered alcohol is a thing now.
Yeah.
Whoa.
But we still can't smoke pot. But we can now snort alcohol.
Well, the Alcohol and Tobacco Tax and Trade Bureau has approved just yesterday the sale of Palcohol. According to its creator, Mark Phillips, it's great for carrying on hiking and camping trips.
Wow.
Just add 6 ounces of water and bam, instant mojito or whatever. Of course, some folks aren't happy. They're concerned about things like snorting it or... I don't know. Yeah, anyway.
Apparently, spiking, it is really painful to snort.
Spiking people's drinks. You know, do we really need another way to drink alcohol? Would it be easier to overdose? Some states have banned the sale of powdered alcohol, and Senator Chuck Schumer has drafted legislation to ban it, which, I don't know.
Okay. Phillips posted a video rebutting many of the concerns. I'd like to play this quote.
You won't get drunk faster by snorting powdered alcohol, and you'll go through a lot of pain. You can see there's absolutely no reason, even for an irresponsible person, to snort powdered alcohol when they can just do a shot in 2 seconds and accomplish the same thing. It's so painful to snort, and it would take so long, it's just impractical.
Practicality is, I think, what a lot of people are looking for.
People inject drugs into their veins. I don't see snorting being a...
I don't think the physical form of alcohol has ever stopped anyone from snorting it in the first place. I mean, how many people here have snorted tequila?
Lord, no.
Snorted tequila?
I'm not saying I have, but I know that people
maybe an
do it.
People do this?
I like to put things in my nose.
People, especially when drunk, people will do a lot of stupid things.
Okay, I would doubt this would happen.
Never been that drunk.
I think reason enough is that you can.
For a lot of people,
happens if we do this, guys?
Well, I have to confess, in preparing for the show, I did a little research. I actually put some vodka in my nose. You know what?
It's not
that bad. It burned a tiny bit, but it wasn't powdered alcohol. I'm sure the form in which I basically dipped my finger in some alcohol and stuck my finger up my nose. So
I'm impressed with your dedication to your art.
You know, it's important to me to be as scientifically accurate as but will this really hurt that badly? I don't think I would enjoy it, but it's probably. And I've never snorted cocaine or any other drug, so it's hard for me to say, but I suspect they all might make you sneeze, at least, at a bare minimum. Anyway, his real focus, though, I suspect, is the more industrial uses for powdered alcohol. He goes on at great length in his videos about how it will save weight on shipping by a third, so airlines stand to save a lot of money, hotels... Hmm. It has industrial uses too. Apparently, it might make a good emergency or lightweight fuel, antiseptics shipped to disaster sites, things like that. Perhaps those are sort of justifications. I'm not really sure because, I mean, obviously, he's coming out with powdered alcohol as a recreational drink. You know, I mean, his first products are like. You know, lemon drops and vodka rum drinks and things like that. So I'm not so sure he's so focused on.
Well, I mean, how long would it take? I mean, again, I'm from West Virginia. How long would it take for some, you know,
moonshiner?
Yeah, I was going to say hillbilly.
to say
like I've got this powdered alcohol. I can just tip it into my gas tank and get a little extra juice.
Well, that would be apparently that's one of the things he's investigating.
I hope that works.
He also did a little demonstration in his video about how hard it would be to spike a drink with powdered alcohol. I mean, he basically had a little pint, a little nip bottle of vodka. And the powdered alcohol, and he poured them both into separate drinks. And of course, as you might expect, the bottle of vodka just mixed right in, and it took him like at least a minute to basically not dissolve the powdered alcohol in the drink. And so his argument is, that's not really an issue. You know what I'm saying?
How do you dissolve? Is it just more time is required, or if you're out hiking or whatever that he was saying?
I don't know. It's hard for me to say.
Depends on what's in the drink, maybe.
Shake it up. Yeah, I mean...
Yeah, you can probably shake it up. I bet that's the way...
Anyway, his argument was it would be really difficult to spike a drink with it, as some people are concerned about.
Right. It is really easy to set yourself on fire with it, though, apparently. I was
scary.
Reading an article about it, and it is very flammable, so there's concerns about the powder getting caught in your clothing when you're camping and then getting too close to the fire. So I don't know if that's a thing that's happened, just that is...
That might obviate the
a
whole
totally
airline.
Different concern that's been expressed.
That might obviate the whole airline use, too. I don't know if I'd want to have extremely flammable alcohol rather than just regular flammable alcohol. Which, actually, vodka isn't really that flammable. I mean...
Anyway, that's just what I read.
I am slightly intrigued, though, by shipping the powdered alcohol to, disaster zones. obviously not a drinking form of alcohol.
The antiseptic.
I'm slightly intrigued about how that would
version.
Work.
Right. I don't know. Maybe they're all really upset after their disaster.
That's right.
They just want to relax.
I guess priorities, right?
Yes. One needs priorities.
The ultimate test, though, will be what does it taste like?
I mean, oh yeah.
You know, and then people are gonna do things like take vodka. And then pour in the powdered alcohol.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, I mean, they're gonna double and triple dose themselves.
Yeah, for sure. That's a good point.
Totally. Yeah, that's worrying.
I can see that.
Also, the cost, because a lot of people, especially like people who just turned 21 or people who have not yet turned 21, are extremely concerned about the cost, and they don't really care about the taste, and they'll just drink whatever gets them drunk. But it's once you get into actual people who are allowed to drink, and then you get some of your connoisseurs. Who will be more concerned about the taste. But, like, there are a lot of people who just want to get drunk.
I think cost is going to be, prohibiting people who are young from using it, because there's no way this is going to be competitive in price if you're, like...
Yeah.
Well, if it saves on shipping, though, that might...
By a third? I mean, that's hardly... Mm. I can't imagine the process, but I don't know what the process is to make it. It's got to be more complicated than distilling vodka or something. You can get a...
Don't you just dry it out? I mean, just leave it on the counter for a while?
So, I mean, you think that...
takes away all the alcohol.
Oh.
You think that about all kinds of processed foods. Like, you wonder, like, how do these apples cost so much more than, like, this bag of Doritos? Because this bag of Doritos has undergone so much processing, and yet somehow it's cheaper. Like, it's I don't really understand food prices get set.
I think it's probably all about efficiency. Like, in the beginning, it's, like, super expensive to make a Dorito, but once you've got it nailed down and you can make a trillion bags of Doritos an hour, then, you know.
Also, shelf life.
Yeah, shelf life.
Oh, shelf life.
That's a good point, too, yeah.
But with alcohol, you have the shelf life built in, because it...
Right.
That's not as big a deal.
I found out an interesting thing about ADHD drugs this week.
That they're basically cocaine?
Well, apparently 1 in 6 college students use it to bolst academic performance. A smaller amount use it to, and this is the thing that interested me, that a smaller amount use it to make it possible to drink beyond the normal limit without passing out. Which seems like
that's not a good idea.
Huh. I had no idea.
That's a really bad idea.
I mean, it just keeps you awake you end up in the hospital getting your stomach pumped, I think.
So dangerous, especially since it makes you not as hungry because it's a stimulant. It makes you not want to eat as much anyway, so you're already not having the food to, like, cushion that alcohol.
So you're just not going
to
get tired.
Oh, that's such a bad idea.
Yeah.
So the idea is you're just not going to get tired and pass out.
That's right.
What I was saying about that ingenuity?
Yes.
That American spirit of, finding a better way, Dave?
Yes, absolutely.
I was thinking this was all due to people wanting to perform better on tests, but here you're telling me it's so they can party harder.
You know what? That's actually not the most common. I mean, that is not the most common. To be fair, the most common usage.
Work hard, party hard.
Most, most use it to bolster.
I think this is work hard, party harder.
Yeah, this was so there have been a lot of claims made about this over the years, and you know they're all, you know, the claims are basically true, that they're being misused in order to, you know, increase concentration and be able to study more, but the University of South Carolina was studying this and basically did a meta-analysis of all these different studies and found out that yes, about 17% of college students are misusing ADHD stimulants. And the most common source of the drug was from their friends. So somebody who has a legitimate need for the drug is basically giving it to their friends. And they don't realize that, haven't fully processed or don't care about the legal ramifications or the medical ramifications of using these drugs. So.
I wonder how they gathered that data.
It was a meta-analysis
of many studies.
So I don't know what that means, really, except that they looked at these studies and processed those studies' results. And so they may inherit, right, the poor research designs, right?
Because if you have a survey and you ask your college student, hey, do you use ADHD medicate, you know, and you can even be sneaky about it too, asking the question, but you're still going to have
underreported. This meta-analysis also, the individual studies range from 2% to 43%, falling in this category with an average of about 1 in 6. So obviously there's a huge amount of variability. So maybe your concern is
probably depends a lot on the school and the culture of the school too.
I would
I would bet that there's a lot of people at UMass doing this, to be honest. Yeah, with you.
Like the more competitive schools or something, or just schools that have more of a, yeah. I don't oh, know, no, that no, kind
yeah.
of culture.
Yeah, yeah, so I should say that at UMass, they're using it to stay awake longer and drink, I'm sure.
Ah, that's the price. I'm glad he's there. That's
all right. What school had that?
They need to stay up longer to throw washing machines out the windows of the tower dorms. Yeah.
And was it Wellesley, or not Wellesley, Wesleyan? Wesleyan. Connecticut that had all those
oh right
that, I think that bad was ecstasy badge.
Is that true? Yeah.
Well, you know, this is something that I've heard about over the years in connection with like high tension, high stress, high study factor things. I've heard it in connection with med students, you know, taking Ritalin or whatever to maintain focus, be able to stay up longer, study, et cetera, et cetera. And I mean, the fact of the matter is, I mean, a college student, anybody in their 20s, they feel like they're bulletproof. They don't know nearly as much as they think that they do.
And they're
willing to try stuff because they don't feel like there's any sort of, you know, any sort of consequence that's gonna come about. So it doesn't surprise me.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wonder why. I always wonder how we decide where to draw the line for what's an appropriate intoxicant and what isn't. Because, like, what's the difference between if I take a Ritalin versus me just loading myself up with coffee, like, hardcore every day,
there's a big
all day,
difference.
And there are a lot of people who do that, and I know, like, chemically there's a big difference, but, like, societally, like, morally, how do we decide when it stops being okay?
I think it's kind of arbitrary based on
cultural. It's very arbitrary. You know? Just arbitrary. Like the smoking and alcohol versus marijuana, same idea.
It's just the cultural gut.
Yeah.
Well, and there's a socioeconomic thing going on as well. I mean, one of the reasons why tobacco is so accepted is that that was how we made money when we first started to colonize this mm-hmm. continent, right? It's like it mm-hmm. became a huge import, and it was really popular among the upper echelons of society in that you know, colonial culture. Whereas something like marijuana wasn't. Alcohol has always been something that was of the people of a higher socioeconomic status as well, mm-hmm. and so therefore accepted. But I think a lot of it does come down to like that icky, like, ooh, this makes me feel good. Like, I feel like a line gets drawn. Like, when you feel really good doing something, society says, like, ooh.
Why is that not okay? Why is that bad? America, you're
roots.
So weird.
That's our roots.
Stupid Puritans.
At heart, we are Puritans. Yeah.
Stupid
Puritans. I mean, it's the same story with the coca plant, though. I mean, the coca plant won't, I mean, it won't do anything bad to you.
It's like drinking coffee.
You have to add a whole bunch of chemicals before you get cocaine, and you know, and but the coca plant is highly illegal in the U.S.
Yeah.
Unless you're Coca-Cola.
Oh, back in the day. And a lot of this, if you look back, there's some really good YouTube videos that I should try to find again. My undergraduate drugs and behavior class, we talked a lot about this, but a lot of the drugs that are illegal and the reasons that they're illegal is because of like racial associations with minorities or with poorer classes. So marijuana was really heavily associated with Mexican immigrants who started pouring in the early 20th century.
Oh.
A lot of people don't realize that, but a lot of them smoked marijuana. And that became this big like taboo thing, and that's when people it started to get outlawed and it started to become such a taboo thing.
Hmm. Well, on that note, I need to close out this addiction drug-related podcast. It's been very interesting talking.
We can stop anytime.
Thank you guys so much.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I totally did not write down my closing credits, but I'm going to give it a shot anyway. The Short Coat Podcast is brought to you by the Writing and Humanities Program and the College of Medicine Student Government. If you would like to leave us a message or talk to us, you can do so at theshortcoat.com/tell us, where we'd love to hear from you. We really, really would. There's a whole bunch of other stuff that I could say here, but I say it every week. You guys hear it. And I bet you're not even, like, as soon as I start talking, you're done with the podcast. You, like, stop, because I say it every week. So I'm not going to say it. I'm just going to be done with it.
okay? Thank you for listening, guys. Appreciate it. Peace.